karne bishvin yama devah padram bhashye makshabhir yajatvah stirai rangai istushtu vagum sastanubhi yashema devahitam yadayuhu swastina indro vrittashravah swastina pusha vishvavedah Swastina starsho arishanemihi, swastino brahaspatir tathatu, om shanti shanti shanti. Going back into the Upanishad, verse 8. If you remember, at the beginning of the Upanishad, it said, Om, this akshara, the syllable, Om, is all of this. Om is everything. And this syllable, Om, is now going to be commented upon. It's going to be elaborated upon as being that which is in the, everything that is in the past, all that is in the present, all that is in the future, that indeed is Om. And everything beyond these three periods of time also, that is Om. So everything is Om. But immediately after that, he went from what we call the Abhidhana. The Abhidhana is the name. Om is the name for Brahman. Right? So Om is the Abhidhana. Actually, you can say Om is the name for Ishvara. Om is the name, and we'll see what I mean by that later. Om is the name, the Abhidhana, for the Abhideya. Abhideya means the thing that it's naming, which is Brahman. So in the very next verse, he says, instead of saying all of this is Om, he says all of this is Brahman, which is the Atma, which is the Self. So he says, Sarvam hietad Brahma, all of this, everything indeed is Brahman, and that Brahman, that Ayam Atma Brahma, and this Atma is Brahman. Everything is Brahman. This self, this Atma, is Brahman. And this Atma has four quarters, chatushpat. A pada is a quarter. So this Atma has four quarters. And then when it went into an unfoldment of the self, of the Atma, which is Brahman, as having four quarters. One was Vishwa-virat. Vishwa was the what they call bahishpragna, external consciousness. Is this physical body, you know, the consciousness, external consciousness is the jiva from the standpoint of this physical body and the whole creation. And then the second pada, the second quarter, was Tajasa and Hiranyagarbha. Just the vrittis, just sukshma, the subtle body. Just the, really the, what you experience in the dream, right? This Vishwa. And then Prajna was the third quarter. And then the one that was free of all of these external, internal, and the prajna, the deep sleep, that was the fourth quarter, the fourth pada. So everything up to this point has been an unfoldment of what we call the abhideya, the thing which has the name, which the name Om has been given to. Okay, so Om has been given to the Atma, which is Brahman, which is everything. And so now we have to come back and look at how is it that Om is an Abhidhana for Brahman? How is it that Om, how does it deserve, how does Om deserve to be a name for Brahman or for the Atma, which is Chatushpat, has these four quarters? So that's what we're, where we are now. So he says, so repeat after me with this verse 8. Soyam Atma Adhyaksharam Omkaraha Adimatram Pada Matra Matrascha Pada Akara Ukara, I'll say Ukara Makara Iti. Let me break the sandhi. Saha Ayam Atma Adhyaksharam Omkaraha etimatram. Padaha, matraha, matraha cha padaha, akaraha, ukaraha, makaraha, iti. Splitting the sentence. Breaking the sentence. So, saha ayam atma, this atma, which is Brahman. We say in Sanskrit, you'll say things like saha ayam, that, this. That atma that we've been talking about is this atma. That atma, which is Brahman, that has been being unfolded, that atma is ayam atma, is this atma. When they say ayam atma, it brings anything distant into immediacy. So if I say ayam atma, this self, this very self which I am, that the self, that Brahman, is ayam atma, this very self that I am. Now it says, so soyam atma, adhyaksharam, from the standpoint, the adhyaksharam, when we're focusing, the adhy means focusing on, or taking into account the akshara. The akshara is the syllable om. So adhyaksharam omkaraha. So focusing on the syllable om, this atma, right? So now we're going to do this very atma, focusing on the omkara as the abhidhana. So here, adhimatram, okay, let me set up this. The syllable om is the atma, okay? So we can say the atma, which is Brahman. So if I say om, that whole om stands for the atma, which is Brahman, okay? But now we can focus on the mantra, each letter of the om. The om, the syllable om is actually made up of three letters. The O, the letter O, is what we call a diphthong. It's comprised of two letters, right? So a diphthong is comprised of two sounds, a and u. The letter I is, in Sanskrit you have two major diphthongs. Well, you have four diphthongs. You have a, I, o, and au. Each one of those diphthongs is comprised of two simple vowels. So for instance, the letter A is comprised of A plus E. O is comprised of A plus U. Right? I is comprised of A plus E. And Au is comprised of A plus U. So here in Om, this letter O comprises two simple vowels, A and U. The third one is M. So Om is really A, U, M. Makes Om, okay? So here he says, we're now going to concentrate on each one of the matras, each one of these letters. And so what he says is, with adhimatram, taking into account the matras, the letters, padaha matraha. Each pada is a matra. The pada, if you remember, the first pada is Vishwa Virat, the waking state. The second pada is the dream state, Taijasa Hiranyagarbha. The third matra is the third pada is the deep sleep state, which is Prajna Ishvara, okay? The deep sleep state. So here, if we focus on each of the matras, each one of the four padas is a matra. So the padas are the matras, padaha, matraha. And the matras are the padas. Okay? Matraha, padaha. What are they? Akara, the letter A, the letter U, and the letter M. So akara, ukara, makara. So A, U, M. When the om is an abhidhana, and we'll see this as we go through now, these things, when you take the om as an abhidhana, as a name for Brahman, any name evokes its content. There isn't really a difference between the name, what they call the pada and the padartha, right? The padartha is the meaning of the name. So for instance, if I say chair, the word chair evokes the object that it's referring to. Right? It doesn't have a being of its own. It's a name of something, right? But the thing is, you have to know what the word means, right? That's why if you say gagabuga, that's not a word. It's not a word that contains meaning. Om also can be a word or a syllable that doesn't evoke any meaning, right? And in which case, when it doesn't really resolve into the vastu, into what it's actually pointing to and actually naming, then that om actually can be used for different types of upasana. I'll get into that, but like a sound symbol, a sacred sound symbol, om. You can do an upasana, a meditation on that sound symbol, you know, and you can visualize certain things about it for meditative purposes. But the word om also, and here in the Upanishad, the word om is meant to resolve into its content, its meaning. And so we're going to, when you take the word om apart and you understand all the matras in relationship to the padas, and you understand om as being a-u-um, then everything with those three, those are only three of the padas, those three padas are evoked when you say the syllable om. And the fourth pada, the fourth mantra, is the silence, right, which surrounds om. That's the what we call a mantra. A mantra means that which is not a mantra. Mantra means a letter. So if we say there's three mantras, a, um, um, the fourth is a mantra, the a negates the mantra. So the three mantras come out of what is nirvikalpa, which is free of any type of form. It's formless, completely formless, because no mantra is and no letter is there. And so if you understand the meaning of a, um, and as we'll see, the a is going to be Vishwavarat, Virat, the waking state, and u is Tajasa, Hiranyagarbha. Now when I say Vishwa, Virat, Vishwa is the jiva that is part and parcel of the whole, Virat, right? If I say this body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishwara, the whole manifest creation, it's not separate. It's not like the creation has come and then the jiva entered in. Just like in your dream, it's not like the jiva or the little, you know, beings enter into the creation after the creation is imagined. The creation is projected, and as part and parcel of the projection are all of the jivas. So when we say, in terms of the waking state, there's Vishwa, the jivas, all of the jivas, that are part and parcel of Virat, the whole, the waking state. In Tejasa, Hiranyagarbha, Tejasa is the jivas in the dream state, or in that those states of experience which only involve vrittis, not any physical form, only the subtle form. So that's Tejasa, and the total subtle is Hiranyagarbha. And so that's the second mantra, U. And the makara, the M, that is the causal state. And so when the Ma is said, it brings to mind prajna, or the Ishwara, or the Maya in unmanifest condition. So how is it that this stands for the waking state, and U for the dream state, and M for the deep sleep state, and the a mantra for the nirvikalpa, for just the non, for Brahman, for the Atman. How is that? What is the relationship? So they try to make this relationship very clear for you, so that actually when you say om, you know, like say if we're saying om as a mantra, if you say om, then what you're seeing is the whole creation rising out of the silence, om rising out of the silence, coming into the Srishti, coming into manifestation, right? And then sustaining, and then resolving. So if say om, the whole Ishwara comes into manifestation, and then it resolves and comes into manifestation and resolves. And so in that particular mantra gives you the experience when you understand what it means, when the meaning is clear for you. In fact, the meaning of Om is in a sense packed with the whole Vedanta. The whole Tatparya of the Vedanta. That Tatparya means the essence of everything the Vedanta is teaching is packed into this Om. And so Om is considered the very sacred syllable. And for a jnani, when all you say Om, it just brings to mind all that is, the nature of all that is. Right, so here, it's so beautiful that, I mean, the whole Upanishad is written on this. So here, let's go to the second verse, because this first one is just introducing what we're going to be doing here. So here, just repeat after me. Jagaritasthano Vaishvanaro Karaha Pratama Matra Aptehe. Well, I'm breaking the Sunday. Matra Aptehe.
Matra.
So what you're seeing is Matra Matrapter. Does everybody see that? Matrapter. Adimatvat. Vapnoti. Havai. Sarvan. Kaman. Adischa. Bhavati. Yevam Veda. I'm going to read it with a Sunday broken and you repeat after me for the people who get learning all of this answer. Jagaritasthanaha. Vaishvanaraha. Akaraha. Pratama Matra. Aptehe. Adimatvat. Va. Apnoti. Havai. Sarvan. Kaman. Adihi. Cha. Bhavati. Yaha. Evam. Veda. So, Jagaritasthanaha, the waking state. Jagarita means waking, sthana means state of experience. So the Jagaritasthanaha, Vaishvanaraha, which is Vaishvanara. Vaishvanara is really Virat. But if you remember when we were talking about Vishwa, or called Vishwa as Vaishvanara, in all three padas, the jiva is equated to, the jiva is actually equated to the sameshti, the total. Because otherwise you would think that there's a self for the jiva which is different from the self for the total, right? And so that's why in the first verses they talk about Vishwa being Saptangaha. The Vishwa that is Saptangaha. Saptanga means the one who has seven limbs. Upasanas are done on the Vishwa, which is Virat, recognizing your being, yourself, this jiva, this atma, as having seven limbs. The seven limbs are this. You meditate, you visualize the head, the heavens as the head. You visualize the prana, the air as the prana, as the vital force. The sun as the eyes. The space as the midsection. The feet as the earth. And the Avaniya fire, the ritual fire where all the ghee and everything is offered into the fire, as the mouth. Because in all of the rituals, the food is offered to the gods through Agni. And so the Ishwara is fed through that. And so it's just it's an upasana. It's a meditation where you're just visualizing the Atma as the whole. And so this Vishwa really, in terms of the conscious being that you are, which in terms of the Jagaritasthana, the waking state, it's also called Bahishpragnaha, external consciousness. I almost did a guided meditation on this today, but it didn't happen. I'm sorry. Get there next time. But the thing is this. when you are aware, we'll just kind of visualize this type of meditation now. Using your sense organs, the waking state requires the use of your sense organs. That's what makes it external consciousness. They mean external as opposed to just vrittis, just like a dream state, or just like, other than just imagination where the sense organs aren't being used. So external is really in reference to this body, in a sense. External to your sense organs. And so if you were to just sit and just totally relax and just be aware of all of the input you're getting, some of which is input from the physical body, like you can be aware of the form of your physical body and all of the kind of muscles and whatever kind of through the sense of touch, whatever you're feeling there through your eyes, whatever you're seeing there. But if your eyes are closed, what you're going to be feeling is your physical body through your sense of touch, and you'll be feeling the chair, you know. But you're also through your other sense organs, you can feel, there'll be a sense of smell, a sense of scent. There'll be a slight, maybe, sense of wind. There'll be sound that is kind of going way beyond even this room. You can hear sound way out into the park and further. And so as you just relax and give up this dehatma buddhi, means this sense of identity with the body, and just be present to everything that is being recognized or picked up through your sense perception. That goes way beyond the physical body. And so that is bahishpragnaha. From the standpoint of bahish means outside, consciousness which is external, means which is being picked up on through your sense perception. This bahishpragnaha for me, even as a jiva sitting here, if I let go of the identification with the physical body, the scope of that experience becomes quite a bit larger. Right? And sometimes, like one thing that we'd always do at the ashram when you're meditating, it's to try to spend some time with your physical body where you're allowing it, bringing in that inner friend and that sort of love and respect for the body, that kind of attitude. And with that attitude, then let the body relax. And then let it relax even more. And let it relax to the point where, if you have your hands like this, often we'll sit with our hands in this way, to where you can't feel them anymore. They're so relaxed that the outlines of the hands are just go away. And then you just allow yourself to be just totally present, totally embodied, and sense organs wide open to just experience the waking state. That's what that is. That is the waking state. And so from the standpoint of Ishvara or Virat, Ishvara in its fullest expression is the waking state. Right? Because the universe is in a totally embodied state, in the waking state. And so this body is only part of that total body, right? And so that's even evident to you, though, as your sense organs realize, that if you realize through your sense organs that not only are the external sounds objectified, but the body is equally objectified. Without your sense organs, this body would be totally unknown. You would be fine, in the sense of your sense organs functioning. Right? Your sense organs, but your sense organs have to be awake, they have to be working in order for this body to be perceived, as well as this world to be perceived. So this body is much an object of Virat, you know, as anything else. And so that's why, when that's so, you can't make, if you make a distinction between the conscious being Vishwa as the body and Virat, then that's misleading. Because this body doesn't enjoy any... It is not any less objectified than any other object. It's not any less a subject-object relationship than any other object. And so, of course, we don't realize that because the sense of touch pervades this body and it becomes a locus for us. You have to slow down and allow that to become objectified. And so here what he's doing when he says, jagaditasthanaha vaishvanaraha. Vaishvanara is usually used for virat. And so what they say in the commentary is that this is just to make you understand that the virat is the vishwa, right? That there's no separate. And taijasa, we'll see it when we go to the ukara, taijasa is Hiranyagarbha, right? In the sense of part and parcel of. They're not separate. It's not like the vishwa has a separate being apart from virat. Vishwa is included in virat. Taijasa, the dreamer, is included in the dream, in the dream world. Prajna is not different. The unmanifest is not different from the unmanifest Ishvara. There's making that point here. So here, and we've made this before in the first half of the Upanishad, so now we're just doing the same thing again, but now from the standpoint of the matras. So here he says, jagaditasthanaha, is the jagaditasthana vaishvanaraha, which is the waking state, is the akara, akaraha, which is the first matra, pratama matra, right? Why is it the first, why is this first matra, the akara, vaishvanara? Why is the a? Why do we break it down like this? Why is a vaishvanara? He says, because the letter a, is all-pervasive, apdehe. Because of being all-pervasive, and let's take that there's two, let's say two things. Aptehe, because of being pervasive, the letter A, as Swamiji always say, if you just open your mouth and make a sound, A, that's the sound. Every other sound is a modification of this sound. So this, the A is the primary sound. So say if I go A, and then I want to make an oo, for instance. I have to do that by using some of the my lips. Ah, oo, right? Or ah, e. E becomes a palatal. There's a palatal repression there, you know. So ah, e, r. I have to bring in the tongue. Ooh, I have to bring in my lips. But what the primary sound is that pervades all of that is ah. And so A is the primary sound. It is also the first sound. So he says, it's the sound that's all pervasive and there in every sound, the principal sound that is there in every sound, so aptehi. Aptehi means pervasive because of being pervasive. And then he says, adimatvat, also because of being the first. And here what they mean, like, or that A is the first letter, okay? And it's interesting, M is the last letter in the alphabet. So A is the first, M is the last. But here, first is given to Vishwa, Vaishvanara, because from the standpoint of waking, dream, deep sleep, it is the waker. I'm in full force here as the waker. It is my dream, and I'm the one that goes to sleep. Right? So, therefore, I come first. The waker is first. It is the waker that goes into the dream. It is the waker that goes into the deep sleep state. And so in that way, they say Vaishvanara is going to be Pratama, the Pratama Matra. Because Apdehe and Adimatvat. Va means Sirjas Cha. And then he says, now this is what is the for Upasana. At the end he says, Yaha Evam Veda. See that at the very end? Yaha Evam Veda. The one who knows this, the one who understands this, this relationship between the A, the first letter, the A, and Vaishvanara, for that person, apnoti havai sarvan kaman, that person, that one, gains all desires. Sarvan kaman. All desires. Okay. Apnoti. He gets everything. He gains all, he fulfills all desires. Apnati havai sarvan kaman. And then adhi. And also, he is first. He is the most exalted. He is the Prathama. He is the most exalted. He is the first. He becomes the first in everything. Okay, so how is that? It's not going to be true for you as a jiva, right? As a jiva, you're not going to fulfill all desires. But if you are the whole, right, then there's nothing left out. So that one, the one, there's other Upanishads, I think this is in the Mundaka Upanishad also, something very similar. As a jiva, what you don't have is infinite. Because the creation is infinite, so all the nama-rupas, all the names and forms, all the possibilities are infinite. So as a jiva, what you don't have is pathetically infinite. That's why Swamiji will say, you know, just be grateful for what you do have. Concentrate on what you do have, because what you don't have is countless. You know? And so here, to say the one who understands this, the one who knows this, what's being talked about, means the jnani, the one who sees it, that person fulfills all desires. Why really? Is because it's really like the animal cracker story. For the one who really understands the ananda or the wholeness or the fullness that I seek is really the self of every nama-rupa. What I'm seeking, what a jiva, an agnani, is seeking from all the names and forms that your desires have landed on, all you're seeking is the ananda, which is my very being. And so once I recognize all of this, really, all of this Vaishvanara is nothing but me, the Atma. But this is nothing but me. Vaishvanara is the consciousness, is the conscious being, right, in relationship to all of this. If I'm just a jiva, then I don't know myself. I don't know the Atma, which is Brahman, my being, which is the self of all of this. I don't know that. I just know that this body, mind, sense organs, is a conscious being, you know, that wants this and wants that and wants that, all based upon my states of mind. Really what I want, the jiva, is just looking continually to get the universe to comply, to fulfill my desire so that I can have a shantavritti. And just work and work and work for these shantavrittis. But the one who knows is not working for a shantavritti. There's no shantavritti to work for. I don't need a shantavritti. In fact, in the end, that's the truth of it. It's nice for an agnani to have shantavrittis. By shantavrittis means a mind that is peaceful and quiet and reflects ananda. And by fulfilling desires, I gain momentary shantavrittis. Because when every time, this is the joke, this is the trick, every time I fulfill a desire, at that moment, for that short period of time, I'm desireless. When I'm desireless, my mind is fine. Why? It doesn't want anything. So you have this little window where the mind is in a condition that reflects the ananda of myself. But that's just a reflection. It's just as though reflection. What I mean is, say you have a shantavritti, a peaceful vritti, you fulfilled a little desire, so you have just a little desire, and then you have this little shantavritti, you know, which is not a very absorbed one, but still, it's not an absorbed shantavritti, but still, it is peaceful and nice and pleasant. But then you can have fulfill a big desire or, you know, a special situation, and you can have an extreme shantavritti that has more shanti than the other vritti. And so now there's more ananda because the mind has a more deep silence and maybe lasts a little bit longer. So this shantavritti is superior to the previous shantavritti. So we have a whole, different levels, different types of shantavritti, so many different types. We like them all, but we also know that we could have a better shantavritti. It's right how it is. This is not so for jnani. This is not so. Because the shanti, we're not as concerned about this shantavrittis. Shantavrittis come and go. There's nothing wrong with them. I'm not putting them down, no, nothing wrong with them, except that they're finite, and they're bound by change. And so they have their own sadness to them, because they come and go. The shanti of your being does not come and go. The shanti of your being, the Atma, the Ananda, the nature of your Atma, of the self that you are, is present to all vrittis, even dukkha vrittis. That's the viveka. And so you no longer ask your mind to be this way or that way. The revelation for me when I got this in full impact of it was just Swamiji said one sentence. Of course, there are thousands of sentences before that. But he said this one sentence that my mind does all kinds of funny things. And then that's what it is. Your mind does what it does. It doesn't matter. Because you're not asking it to be your source of ananda, and you're not asking the world to be the source of ananda either. Both things have to be there. I'm not asking the world or expecting the world to be the source of ananda, which means that I can let things come and go, kind of like riding on water, or the bird flying through the air doesn't leave any tracks, or riding through water, it makes its mark, and then it disperses. So you watch the world makes its mark, and it disperses. Your mind makes its mark, and it disperses. But the one that is its very being is always there, always the same, and is always whole and complete. And so that allows the Saravan Kaman, when we say all of these desires, all of the he attains all the desires, because if it doesn't, what if he attains, you can take it like this, he attains all desires, Sarva Kaman, everything he ever wanted, or she ever wanted. Everything. Because everything is, has the one content, which is the ananda of myself. On another level, I am all of this. There is no thing that is not me, in terms of my being. But if you look at it as animal crackers, you know, when you recognize that, then you become more and more and more free to enjoy, you know, your little piece of prarabdha. The piece of prarabdha that is yours for a jiva. You're living this life from birth to death. So you have this is your prarabdha, it's all given. You know, and you stop thinking, you know, like, well, the Joneses have this prarabdha. The Joneses get to do this, and you know, George gets to do this, and you know, Mary gets to do this, and I'm stuck with this. But if it's all graham crackers, you know, if it's all, you know, these animal crackers, I can more and become more and more comfortable in what I actually, the situation, the Ishwara that's actually present to my sense organs. It's all Ishwara. But from the standpoint of the jiva, the individual, this is what's present. This is the Ishwara that's present to me at this moment. And that Ishwara includes, because the Ishwara is the whole, but or the Vaishvana or the Virat is the whole. But this jiva is, warp and woof is part and parcel of that. But with the individual sense organs, this is my sphere from the standpoint of this jiva. This is what's being experienced by me. And you know what? This is also what's being experienced by my mind. We'll see that more with Prajasa, but that is also Ishwara, the whole set of experience. But the thing is, with your mind, the mind you have some control over. Right? You have a lot of control over it, actually. You don't have very much control, in a sense, over the prarabdha karma. But how the mind is in the middle of that prarabdha karma, you know, there's a lot of difference. It's the same difference, that's why we say the rope snake story. There's a big difference in your mental, the way you are, in reference to the snake versus the rope. There's quite a difference. In the 10th man story, there's a huge difference. between the tenth man believing that they've lost the tenth man, he's drowned in the river, and realizing I'm the tenth man. And there's a big difference. There's not so much you can do. We don't have so much control over the world that's given to us as part of our prarabdha, you know. But the way it impacts us is a huge difference. And so your mind does change. It changes a lot. It changes a lot because it's not asking the same things of the world. You know? So what if this situation, you know, is fine with me? You know? What if I accept this situation as it is? And how can I really do that? If I think that the ananda or the wholeness or well-being itself is dependent on the situation being a particular way. Like this person gets to be happy, I don't. You know, this person gets to own this, I don't own this. If I own that, I would be happy. What if I don't think like that? What if I don't superimpose ananda, the wholeness of my being, the ananda that I seek onto the world? You know, when I'm superimposing the ananda that I seek onto the world, then I'm running after that. When I don't superimpose it anymore, then I'm abiding in the ananda of my own being, enjoying my own being. And when I'm not asking the world to be catering to me, then I'm free to appreciate it as Ishwara. Then it's a whole different relationship. And so here when he says, you know, the one who gains from the standpoint of Vijnani, the one who realizes, the one who understands this relationship between the akara as Vaishvanara, and say, if I understand that, then for me all desires are gained. I can also do an upasana on this creation, on the of Om. I imagine the akara, as the Lord, as Virat. And then imagining the akara as my being, as Virat, then I attain everything. Right? Because I'm imagining my being, the self, as the Lord, as Virat, and then everything is mine, and I am foremost. I am the foremost. There is nothing more exalted than me. As Virat, you know? But I can go a step further as a jnani, and I recognize that the very ananda of my being is the being of the Vishwa and the being of Virat. I am the self of the whole. And so that's the Jivanmukta. So the one who knows this, or the one who does upasana on it, achieves all desires. Right? Either because you do an upasana of yourself as Vaishvanara, who is everything, right? And so now I see myself as everything, or I see myself as everything because my being, because of knowledge, because my being is the self, which is the very ananda of the whole creation, right? From the standpoint of the waking state. Okay, so let's do one more. Go to the going to the dream state. Swapnasthanas Tajasa Ukado Dvitiya Matrutkarsha Matrutkarshad Ubayatwad Vodkarshati Havai Jnanasantitim Samanascha Bhavati Nasya Brahmavit Kule Bhavati Yaevam Veda. I'm going to break the sentence, so repeat after me. Swapnasthanaha Taijasaha Ukaraha Dvitiya Matra Utkarshat Ubhayatvat Va.
Va.
Utkarshati.
Utkarshati.
Havai.
Havai.
Jnana santatim.
Jnana santatim.
Samanascha.
Samanascha.
Bhavati.
Bhavati.
Na asya.
Na asya.
Abramavit.
Abramavit.
Kule.
Kule.
Bhavati.
Bhavati.
Yaevam Veda.
Yaevam Veda.
So he says, Swapnasthanaha, the dream state, Swapnasthanaha, is Tajasa. Tajasa is the name of the, from the jiva, the total is Hiranyagarbha. Tajasaha, who is the dream state? And remember, the Tajasa is always going to be Hiranyagarbha, include Hiranyagarbha also, because of the same Saptanga. Because on the subtle level also, this Saptanga is also imagined. It's also... are also the limbs of Vishwa, because the truth of the limbs of Tajasa, because the truth of Tajasa is the antapragna, inner consciousness. It's consciousness from the standpoint of the dream state. So remember the Saptanga, the seven limbs are the heaven is the head, prana, the winds are the prana, the winds of the prana. The akasha, the space, is the midsection. The sun is the eyes. The feet are the earth, and the havaniya, fire, is the mouth. So I'm not leaving one out. I don't think so. So here the Tajasa is now the ukara. It's which is dritiya matra, which is the second matra, the second letter, because okay? So now, why is it the second letter? So he says, ukarashat, because it's superior. It's superior to the akara. How is it superior? How is the ukara superior? Well, superior in that it comes second, one thing, comes second. It's superior, which doesn't make a lot of sense, but that's what it is. Becomes second. Also because it is more subtle. And he says also, it's ubayatvat. Also because it's ubayatvat, because of being in between the two. So the sukshma sharira, the vritti, the dream state, or the imaginal state, or just pure vritti, which is, the vrittis are responsible for thinking, you know, for imagining, for desiring. The vritti is, the vrittis, the mind is really what controls the body, right? It's because you want to do something, you want to raise your arm, so you raise your arm. So there's kama involved. Kama means desire. So the subtle body, or the vrittis control, in a sense, the physical body, or they use the physical body. And so in that way it's upkarsha, but it's also interior to the physical body, using the physical body, pervading the physical body, and is also in between the deep sleep state, right? And so it's sandwiched between the waking state and the deep sleep state, where the jiva is not fully manifest. Right, all that's manifest is the subtle body. So it says ubayatvat. It's like the example that is used for this is famous example is if you put a lantern in a doorway. Say there's an outside door, your front door, and you put a lantern right on the doorway. Then that lantern is lighting up the room and the outside. So like that, the subtle body, or the vrittis, are between, sandwiched between the waking state and the deep sleep state. So the deep sleep state, the dream resolves into the deep sleep state, comes out of the deep sleep state, and it's also the dream, the dream, or the vrittis that are also functioning with the physical body also. And in fact, when the physical body is here, it's not that Taijasa is gone, you know. It's not like this two, all of these states are negate each other. They do in a sense in terms of waking and dream. But when you're in a waking state, you're also imagining, you're also daydreaming, you're also lost in thought. This is all Taijasa, right? So the Taijasa is also present in the waking state, right? And Ajnanam also is present in the waking state also. So all three of these are functioning in all three states in a sense, but they use the waking state and the dream state and the deep sleep state to show what they are in and of themselves. Because if you look at the waking state and the dream state and the deep sleep state, these negate each other. Right? And so the three states are, even though they combine together, in their pure form, they totally negate each other. When you're dreaming, there is no deep sleep or waking state being experienced by you. Right? And when you're waking, you're not dreaming and you're not deep sleeping. So the three states negate each other is what's very important in this Upanishad, because the Atma is not negated in any of them. Right? The conscious being that you are is present in all three. So these states come and go, but you don't. Right? Even though the one who's commenting on this is in the waking state. Right? The waker says, I dreamt. And the waker can describe it clearly. And when you're dreaming, your mind is awake, so you remember. But from the waking state, you'll be commenting on it. The dreamer usually isn't commenting on the waking state or the deep sleep state. The deep sleep state isn't commenting on anything. Right? And so the waker will say, I had this dream last night. And when I'm dreaming, there is no wake. They can go on and on. You can do a whole lecture on it. When I'm dreaming, there is no waking state, there is no deep sleep state. It's just me, and I can take another body in the dream, I can give a whole lecture on it. In the deep sleep state, there is no waking state, there is no dream state available to me. There's no experience of duality, subject-object duality. That's the waker talking about these three states. And so since the waker can, and the waker is the one that gets knowledge also, and so these three states are because the waker is available for Vyavahara, for this empirical reality with which to gain knowledge. And so these three states are so important in terms of being able to recognize, have viveka, to differentiate the one who is not negated in all of the three. So even if you take the waking and the dream, they negate each other. Everything that you take yourself to be is negated in the dream state and the deep sleep state. So the one that you are is going to be the one that can't be negated. If you can be without something, that thing is incidental to you. It's incidental. Incidental means it's not you. Your being does not depend upon it. And so it's only the one that is there present to all states of experience. And you can take that we can do the same type of viveka in the waking state, the one that is present to all states of experience. All moods, all emotions, all perceptions, all memories. Whatever is being experienced, the experiences that come and go have to be differentiated from the one who is always there. If the instant something's gone and I'm still there, then I have to say my being is not dependent upon that experience. Right? My being is free of that experience. When you get down to just the brass tacks of who you are, you have to be the one who is non-negatable. Right? So here he says, so he takes for this mantra, he cut a shot. Because of being experienced more subtle, more innermost, and ubayatvat, because of being in between the other two. Now there, when you say, everything is open, everything is closed, right? In between is So if you just think of So just phonetically like that, is in the middle of those two. So now he gives for that the the pola. He says, Ya'evam Veda, the one who knows in this manner, what happens? He becomes one who Utkarshati Havai Jnanasampatim. He becomes one who increases. Utkarshati means to increase or to elevate. He elevates or increases the flow of knowledge. The santati is the Guru Sisha Parampara, the flow of jnanam. Here, the jnana santati is he increases the sampradaya, the flow of knowledge. He elevates the santati, means the continual flow of something. So here it's the continual flow of knowledge. And they're talking about atma-jnanam, because it's the, we'll see by the next example. Because he says, the one who understands this, then he elevates, he raises, he increases the flow of knowledge, means the flow of this Upanishad knowledge of the Upanishads. So he increases that jnana santatim, the flow of the knowledge, and he says, and he is samanaha. Samanaha means, for him, he is equal to all beings. Which means that in terms of his friends and colleagues, people don't envy him, are not jealous of him. And of his enemies also, so his friends and his enemies, people see him as being the same. They don't, because there's no competition. There's two things there. There's no sense of competition, because there's no sense of competition, and also there's no rejection. So people feel included, and so people feel on an equal level, even though they may respect and look up to and love, they don't feel different from. In fact, they feel one with, because there's nobody pushing you away, and nobody asking you to be different, and nobody feeling that they're better than you. And so when all that type of ego stuff is gone, then you yourself don't feel, you feel equal to, and even the enemy, this is from Shankara, even the enemies also, dvaishti, there's no feeling of inequality. So there's a sense of sameness or equality or oneness. It's interesting. So he says, the utkarshati, jnanam santati, and samanaha. There's no sense of competition or feeling less than. And then he says, and for that one, and for him, asya, na asya, abramavit kule bhavati. There is no one in his family, in his kula, who doesn't know Brahman. Abramavit. It's a double negative. There is no one who is abramavit. Vit means a knower. There is no one that doesn't know Brahman in his kula, in his family. And so Swamiji took this. The teachers in India, the guru, there's the guru-sisha relationship. The students make up the kula, that is the guru's family. Mm-hmm. So we say Arsha kula, the guru kula. That's why Swamiji gave this name that we have, Arsha Kula. It's a family, it comes from the family born of the rishis. So the guru, the Guru Kula, that's the family of the guru. So that's in India, it's always the Guru Kula. So now, the one who understands this, for that one, all of their progeny, means all of their students, all of them will know Brahman. Because why shouldn't they? Why shouldn't they? How can somebody be exposed if this one is the student, if the guru-sisha relationship is there, then why would that student not know Brahman if the student has come to the Gurukula and this knowledge is being taught by one who knows it, then why would they not know Brahman? So that's how Swamiji took it. Because he's all, just a little aside here, because, he will sit for 3 and a half years, and just teach every day, and give contemplation and teach every day. The morning class, then Sanskrit, then 11 o'clock or morning class, then like an 11 o'clock class, then a 5 o'clock class, then an evening satsang, the early morning meditation, then Sanskrit every day. So this goes on every day for 3 and a half years. Taught by him. Okay? So now he'll say, how is it possible for a student, it's not possible for a student to come and be exposed to that teaching, which is so thorough, you know, by somebody who can teach it, who knows how to teach it, which he does. It's not possible. It's not possible. But there is no possibility of there being an Abramavit in this kula. I think it's true. If the Shraddha is there, if that Shraddha is there, if the Shraddha is there, that not there, then there's no entryway. That's why they think that just in the tradition, you know, that that Shraddhavan Labhate Jnanam. It's in the Gita, in fact. Very famous verse. It's always chanted, always recited. The one who has Shraddha, that one gains knowledge. Labhate means gains. Shraddhavan, the one who has Shraddha, that person gains knowledge. Because with that Shraddha in Ishwara, Shraddha in the Upanishad, Shraddha in the Acharya. You know, you have to, when they say Shraddha, it's really in the Upanishad and the Acharya. They put those two things together. But then the Ishwara is involved also, because how can you have Shraddha without having any Shraddha in Ishwara?
Mm.
Yeah. You can't have Shraddha for the Upanishad in the Upanishad and Shraddha for the Acharya, the teacher, if you don't have Shraddha in Ishwara. It's not possible. Yeah. So, because it's all contained within the same, within that, you know, within that tradition, all of these things are. And so, if you have Shraddha in the Upanishad, then you can't not have Shraddha in Ishwara, because Ishwara is what's taught in the Upanishad. And so, you can't have Shraddha in one without the other. So if you have the Shraddha in Ishwara and Shraddha in the teacher and Shraddha in the teaching, then there's no way of, even in terms of the antakarana shuddhi, all of these things have to come. They have to come. Because if there's Shraddha and Ishwara also, then that karma yoga buddhi, which is part of the teaching, has to come. It has to be understood and has to come. That brings about the antakarana shuddhi. There's all these upasanas, you know, and meditative exercises that bring about what we call this antakarana naishchalya, this steadiness of mind. The teacher is there, the teaching is there, you're there, you have a mind, you have Shraddha, and the teaching is about yourself, you know, and yourself is there.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you not know? How is it possible to not know? It's kind of like, they use this example, like if, now I'm in this room, and that painting is over there, okay, it is there. So now, all I have to do is direct my eyes at the painting. So if I'm sitting here and my eyes are focused at that painting, I will see it. What am I going to do? Say if I'm looking at, how can I can't be like this, looking at the painting and say, all right, don't see the painting. Don't see it. Stop seeing it. Stop seeing it. You can't not see it. This is how pramana works. You have ears. There is sound. You know, you hit. Don't hear. No. If the ears are here and working and your mind is present to the ears, then you will hear the sound. And like that, you are here. The your being, who you are, is here. The teaching is here. As long as your mind is present, you can't not see. That's the idea. But your mind has to be present. That's why, to understand, this is kind of an important thing to understand. When they talk about antakarana shuddhi, this purity of mind. Purity of mind. This, do I have a pure mind? You know, but they mean, to understand what they mean by purity of mind. It means simply that your mind has enough shanti to be available for the teaching, which takes place through words. It's shabda pramana, right? Now, if the mind is available, that means that it has the ability to rest, to focus. Now, that in terms of this teaching, that requires a lot. Even to be interested in this requires something unusual to be interested in this, because most people's mind are interested in acquiring things and getting things and very busy. You're thinking about many, 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 many other things, full of raga dvesha. And the raga dvesha, the likes and dislikes, they take the mind away. But raga dvesha, it's not just raga dvesha, it's all the enmity that comes from raga dvesha. Raga dvesha themselves generate desires and generate emotions and feelings toward the people that are helping you to satisfy your raga dvesha and the people that are getting in your way for satisfying the raga dvesha. The whole world breaks up into an emotional turmoil, you know, and then you can be mad at your family and your parents and the people that were in your life before now that screwed everything up for you, that now have left you in this situation, that, you know, we have all kinds of baggage, you know, and so that baggage takes time to unwind. But if that shraddha is there, that Ishwara arpana buddhi, you know, and that Ishwara is there, and that karma yoga buddhi is there, all of these things unwind. And then in the teaching, if you have a good teacher, I mean, like for me, Swamiji is the teacher of teachers, you know, who is able to trick your mind into having some momentary shanti by telling all wonderful jokes all the time. He'll be telling such good jokes. Everybody will be laughing so hard. And then their mind has this shanti, and then he'll throw in some things. And you see, you know, because your mind's relieved of pressure for the moment. And then this teaching comes, and it comes in, and you see it, you know. And that seeing it helps to support the mind's work on kind of resolving some of these complexes and issues and all of this. So the teaching itself, you know, includes so many aids, you know, to gaining enough the shanti that you need to be able to gain this knowledge. And so that's how Swamiji will take it, because another thing to understand says, Yaha Evam Veda, the one who understands this, the one who knows, that person's a jnani, the one who knows this, then in that person's kula, means gurukula, right, there won't be an abramavit. Not possible. Right? Because he or she's not an abramavit, you know. That teacher knows. And so the teacher can make the student know. Should be like that. And that samana where there's no enmity on the part of the teacher. You know, there's no enmity inside the teacher, then nobody feels less than. It's enmity or all of these things that make us feel separate from one another. When that's not there in one person, you know, and the other person doesn't feel it either. When it's not there in the one person, then it doesn't evoke it out of the other person. So when it's not there in great measure, when that enmity or that competitiveness or whatever the things are that we suffer from is absent in great measure, being in the presence of that person transforms you also. Mm. Yeah. So all of that is in his kind of a praise. It's a beautiful, beautiful praise for the one who knows. Okay, let's start. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Sense organs.
What they mean by sense organs are just the five sense organs. Your eyes, your sense of hearing, eyes, sense of touch. I mean, the actual order they give it in terms of subtlety, it goes the ears, the sense of touch, the eyes, sense of taste, and the sense of smell. So those are the five sense organs. The antakarana is not considered a sense organ because it's the instrument, it's more than a sense organ. It's the instrument, antakarana means mind. It's the instrument to which all of the sense organs feed into. Like your eyes can only see and your ears can only hear, but we're seeing and hearing at the same time, right? And feeling. So that's the mind is like the receptacle of those five sense organs, and it does things on its own also. Like the mind can remember, it has memory, it has the I thought, it has the intellect, it has the manas, the fluctuating mind, and also the emotions. So
I heard it said that sense organs doesn't refer to, in Vedanta, doesn't mean that physical, that, like the eyes,
oh,
but the capacity to see.
Okay, yeah. It's
so
the, oh, I
is
see.
That,
I didn't realize.
Is that how you're using it? Or
yeah, yeah.
Using
yeah, the sense, when I say eyes, I mean the eyes, the subtle body with the five sense organs are which are subtle embodies, comes into the physical body, you know, and those subtle sense organs use the physical instruments. So they say when the body dies and the sukshma sharira, the subtle body leaves, all the functions of the body also go. So they look at the subtle body as the five sense organs, so they're subtle, right? They're using the physical eyes, but they're subtle capacities. So the five sense organs, the five pranas, the in-going, out-going, breath, circulation, and circulatory system, digestive system, peristaltic movement, and then the karmendriyas, your hands and your feet, and your vak, your speech, evacuation, sexuality. So you've got the five subtle sense organs, the five organs of action, the five pranas, that's 15. And then you have the four different types of mental functions, which would be like the citta, which is memory, the buddhi, which is the intellect, the manas, which is the fluctuating mind, the emotions, and then the ahankara, the I notion. So those 19 components are what, as a whole, called the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, that transmigrates. And this physical body is only alive when the sukshma sharira is with it.
So it's some kind of animating, it's this conglomerate of different things.
Well, it breaks it up like that. You can look at it as a conglomerate. When I say, if I want to break, well, okay, my hands move, right? And so my feet walk. And these, so I look at all of the capacities and I divide them up into these overarching components.
But it's not really so. It's like an elephant has a tail and a snout, but they're really both the elephant.
Yeah, you're right, and they all come together.
But it's just, I guess I'm a little mystified by what it is.
What it is? Well, that's because I think that it is simple in the way they describe it, but you have to, how to think about it is that this physical, that when this physical body drops, is there a soul? A soul? Is there something which continues on? And if that's what they call the jiva, so in a simplistic sense, so the one that travels, that continues on, what continues on? If there's such a thing as a soul that lives when the body dies, that continues, What is that that continues on, and where does it go? Right? And so the Vedanta, the Upanishads, talk about that, and the first part of the Vedas also. They talk about that in some detail. We're still all within Maya, but then people want to know that. So what they look at is the Sukshma Sharira. Sukshma Sharira means subtle body. Sharira is body, Sukshma is subtle. Sukshma Sharira. This is Stula Sharira, the gross body, the physical body. So they look at the Sukshma Sharira as taking body after body after body on different levels, on different planes of existence, based upon one's karma. And so they see that this life that you have is one of many. This is just one, it's like one dress in a way. It's like one day in the life of, but this life is one life of many, many lives. And each life really leads into the other based upon the total karmas of this life. What happens when, and your last moment, you know, when you're ready to leave this body, who are you at that moment? What is your last thought? That last thought, which is not something that you have any control over, really, it's just because there's no will at that point.
You mean it comes out as a summary of your whole life when you have this last thought?
Kind of, in who you are. You know, who's the one continuing on? That's the trajectory.
Mm.
Well, look at, just like, don't make it into a mystical thing.
No.
But just like this moment right now leads into the next moment. Who I am at this moment leads into the next moment, leads into the next moment. So that moment of death, that who you are at that time is what leads to the trajectory, sets the trajectory for your next birth. And the part of the sanchitta karmas, the karmas that have not been fructified yet, that are countless in number, those karmas are the ones that will come into being for the next life. And there's so many other things to consider, like the time and place. But, I mean, everything has to fit. If you're born here, now, all kinds of things have to come into play here to make it work for you, because you're part of Ishwara. This is part of Ishwara. Now, all of us are part of Ishwara, so it's kind of complex. When you think of it, all the different jivas that are here and all the things that are required in the universe at this time, everybody's playing their part. And so you have a place here, we all have a place here. Because we're all manifest. Here we all are. You have an important place. You're the only one that can fill your place. You are that place. It's kind of interesting, really.
Sushma.
So you should do your job well. Sushma?
Sharira. It includes the samskaras.
It includes the samskaras, the tendencies from previous lives, and also all the sanchitta karma. So like if we look in terms of the unconscious, our unconscious, like Jung will have the shadow and then the collective unconscious. If we were to do it, we would have to have something in the unconscious where all of the sanchitta karmas are stored. Something like that. We don't do that in Vedanta. They don't have an unconscious. They a lot of things they say imply one, but the word unconscious is Western.
I'm always kind of fascinated by prodigies, you know, that...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Samskaras.
Yeah. You were talking about having Shraddha and Ishwara. Is that in reference to the pramana, or does it go more than that?
Goes more than that. But I mean, Ishwara, this jiva is part and parcel of Ishwara. Right. So even if you don't know that, because you don't have, until you have knowledge, you don't really understand the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But say in India, Ishwara is God. Their whole concept of God is a Vedic concept, not a Western concept.
Mm-hmm.
So their understanding of Ishwara is the whole. They understand they have just a knowledge of. A simple understanding of reincarnation, they never doubt it, because that has thousands of years You know, and that the Eastern cultures just accept that as a fact, and they accept the different levels, lokas, and they accept Ishvara, you know, as being the whole.
They accept him in a way of that he's benign and careful for. In what way do they?
Well, it depends, you know, until you really. There's just so many different manifestations of Ishvara, you know. So how, the way they hold Ishvara is in many different ways, but it's all kind of, it's all Vedic. All the devatas and all the deities. The one who's benign is Brahman. When you look at Ishvara as the whole, there's everything happening in Ishvara. Everything is happening that is imaginable. That's why the Vedas are a handbook, and the Vedas are centered on Dharma. Dharma is what protects you from, you know, from Papa. And so Dharma becomes very, very important. In India, you know, you are, in some sense, responsible for your lot. And so Ishvara can help you, you know. But it's your punya and papa that causes, the combination of your punya and papa that causes your, whatever birth and whatever situations that you're faced with. It's not Ishvara striking you down for no reason. But that's more Western, really, is there is no reincarnation. There's this birth. And then whatever comes after, this birth. But when you think about it, okay, then why did this person, there's no prior condition, why did this person get a good birth with all good things, and this person gets so much suffering? How do you account for all that? And then there's only one life. Right? So it's your only shot. And then some people get so much and some people don't get anything. So what kind of a just God is that? Some, you know, in the, because of the, well, I won't go into that. Never mind. Never mind.
So the difference there is they see it they're responsible for the punya and papa, and that's why
they can also always pray for Bhagavan to help them and intervene and
help out with the papa.
Yeah, intervene and, you know, neutralize the papa. We have all kinds of rituals and things for that.
Mm. Could you say? I mean, it seems like there's a little bit of a cultural translation here that doesn't completely fit to the Western culture.
Yes.
And there's another thing that's coming up for me. It's bugging me for some reason. It seems like there's an exception to the Brahmavit thing, that someone who's new isn't necessarily
new means what?
A new student, say. Someone new to the Kula.
Yeah.
Isn't necessarily a knower of Brahman.
No, but the idea, there's different ways you can take this. Like if you talk about it like where Swamiji was talking about it, then a student that comes to you, the teacher, will not go away not knowing. If a student, not that they'll come and know, but they won't go away not knowing. They will gain knowledge. And then say if you look at yourself... However long it takes, yeah. Yeah, you'll gain knowledge. It's a praise. Or you can take it as everybody who's born into your family, you know, and so everybody who's born into your family, they will also know. There's one thing, I'm just making this association right now, but in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna asked Krishna, what will happen, now you've taught me all of this, but what will happen if I get killed in battle, because I haven't had enough chance to really assimilate it, what will happen to me? And he said, no one should ever fear, once you've been exposed to this knowledge, you know, once you've been studying this knowledge, then if you die before you complete, then you'll be born into a, you'll be either born into a family of yogis, means of jnanis, you know, where you'll pick up the thread right away, or you'll be born into a family of dharmanishtas, dharmis, you know, and then, because you have some karma that has to be exhausted, some additional karma that has to be exhausted, and then you'll pick up the thread.
That sounds great, but how does that work? I mean, I'm a little skeptical.
Yeah, well, all that kind of stuff requires some shraddha, right? You have to be kind of contained within the culture for that, and kind of have an understanding also of the relationship. Say, for instance, you're transmigrating birth after birth after birth. You have what we would have what's called Vedanta samskaras. Say, for instance, that we use this term. Say you were studying Vedanta, and say you're one of those people who come to this teaching when they're like 65, and they'll always be often say, "Oh, I came to this teaching so late. If only I would have come when I was a young person. I came to this teaching so late, you know." But then they study, you know, so they study for 15 years or 20 years, they've devoted their life to understanding this, and then they die, and then they're reborn with a Vedanta samskaras, and they pick up this knowledge when they're young. And then some old person is saying, "Oh, you got this knowledge. You're getting this knowledge when you're so young. I wish that I could have done it."
Krishna states this as a natural law. I mean, applicable to the creation.
Exactly. They consider this as really part of the creation, just like the idea that when you become a mumukshu, really, a seeker who's asking the proper questions, not a seeker. Say you're, I'm a seeker. I have to be able to astral travel. You know, then that's not going to be, that's not a seeker for this particular thing that we're talking about. But once a person becomes a mumukshu, as defined by how they're defining it, then at that time a person meets their teacher, you know. And not any later, not a moment later. When you're ready for that, then you get it. Otherwise it's not right. Even when Upanishad said, you know, Bhagawan, he did this, he made all the sense organs going outward. You know, all of our, he made them all going outward. This isn't Katha Upanishad. He made them all going outward. He didn't make one that goes inward to know the self. Right? And so therefore the sense organ, the Upanishad is the sense organ for that. Mm. You know, and it's not something that you, and they will say, like, you don't need that. You don't need that until you need it. And when you need it, then you'll get it. And once you get it, then you don't need it anymore. once it's over, you know, once you've gotten it, then you don't need it anymore, because it's yourself. The ajnanam has been removed and you're always there. So it's, and the self that you are is self-evident. The ignorance has been removed. Doesn't require a sense organ. And they use the example of, it's kind of like you go to the edge of a river, right, and you get in a canoe to take you across the river. Or a raft. So you take into the raft and you take it all the way across the river. Get across the river, and then you don't have to carry the raft with you. Nor do you want to. You know? It's done its job. It's got you across the river, and then you go your way. You don't carry it with you.
But and some you, people, and you like yourself, are still interested in Vedanta. I mean, maybe as a teacher.
But what's wrong with that?
No, I'm just saying that you're still with the raft.
Oh.
In a certain way.
I see.
I mean, it's just where the metaphor breaks down.
Yeah.
I mean, interesting.
Yeah, like I just carried the raft
around. You just carried the raft because you like the raft.
I like the raft.
It's a cool raft.
I keep the cool raft on my head.
Where else
are you going? No, but that
is the iPhone.
No, it's not like that. It's not like that. It's not like that.
It's cool.
It's cool, but that's not the metaphor breaking down. That's the metaphor going way beyond what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, that's not true.
But here,
it's a different karma for a teacher.
No, it's, I didn't think about it like that. You're not carrying knowledge. Knowledge rests very lightly because it is you. You're not carrying a big burden of knowledge around with you. You know, but then there's nothing greater than this knowledge either.
So if you didn't have the raft, you'd still be okay. I mean, after taking you across the river.
This is broken down.
Yeah. Like the vegetarian.
There are some people who, once they get knowledge, they lose interest in studying and write. They just move on and do something else. And, you know, weave baskets, whatever they do, play music. Is that true? I've heard that.
Where?
What? It's not quite like that.
No.
You may not be a teacher, but be a teacher, or even be writing. But once you have this knowledge, there's no leaving it. Because it is you, you know. It's not like you gain this knowledge and then you weave baskets. You gain this knowledge, and having this knowledge, then what you're doing is weaving baskets. But there's no coming or going of your knowledge, you know.
But you're not necessarily teaching and studying Upanishads.
No, I think that, I don't think that's a required. But it's going to be going internal. I don't think that you have to be studying all the time or teaching all the time. If you have knowledge, you'll just be, you are that knowledge. That's the thing, it's not, it rests very lightly because it's you. So everything you see is not away from what you know. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Intellectually.
Yeah. No, you know, people, not everybody who has knowledge is a teacher. It's not their thing. And not everybody likes to study a lot either. That's also not their thing. You know, like being really bookish, not everybody's like that. Some people are like that somewhat. But if a person's a jnani, they're a jnani no matter what they're doing. And they're, even if they're basket weaving or playing tennis or whatever they're doing, it's not apart from who they are.
Self-knowledge doesn't go away.
No.
Maybe the interest in the Shruti and other stuff.
This, yeah, constant study and all of that. That doesn't have to be, and it can be also. It doesn't matter. Because otherwise, everyone who's a jnani has to be somebody who just likes to study.
Yeah. You know, but then the raft is more self-knowledge and not necessarily...
This is the point for that. You don't have a sense organ for knowing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Mm-hmm.
It's not attached to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need to, it needs to come and be available to you at the right time.
But you need a pramana.
You need a pramana. But the pramana is not built in. And so you need the pramana until it does its job, and then you don't need that pramana anymore. Because it's done its job. And the knowledge that you needed to gain, you have now. And so you don't need to carry the pramana around with you because you already have the fruits of that pramana. And the thing is like, say, I need my eyes to see that painting, you know. And if I look this way, the painting's not there. But here, the subject is me. And once I've recognized myself, it doesn't require my eyes or my ears or anybody to keep telling me, because I'm already recognized myself, and myself is self-evident, and it never goes away. It's the very self of every thought I have, of every experience I have. So, you see what I mean? So
yes.
I don't need a pramana.
Well, when you see it, is it always a big experience?
No.
Shift from not having self-knowledge to having self-knowledge?
See,
crossing that line is...
When you say big experience, I think of some big meditative, expansive experience that's not present right now. And that is not true. You can have big, expansive experiences, but who you are is present right now, fully, completely. Even if you're an Ajnani or Jnani, it's fully, completely present right now, but it's not discerned. And so once it's discerned, everything changes in terms of what the mind needs or wants or is looking for. The problems of the mind are basically resolved. The fundamental problem of the mind, of seeking its own fullness or wholeness or oneness with God, all of these things that are fundamental for a person, fundamental needs for a person, those are gone. And yourself, as you are, is self-evident without all of this superimposition taking place. Whereas otherwise, you are self-evident, but with lots of baggage belonging to you. So once yourself is known, then your mind has a home. Everything that's mitya has a home. And that home is stable and it's wholeness and ananda. See what I mean? And I don't need a pramana for that because I'm the subject that's, I've already been, that I'm all, I know myself is already self-evident in relationship to everything that's mitya. See, that's why we say knowledge is really ajnana nivritti. It's the nivritti, the elimination, the removal of ignorance. It's not the gain of something new. It's removing the ignorance that has caused all this superimposition and taking what I need to be whole, to be out here, so I have to collect it. You know, and that's the grand illusion. You know, I fulfill a desire, I get a shantavritti, and then the shantavritti goes away right away. You know, but I do get the shantavritti. That's why the fulfillment of desires are so compelling. Because when you fulfill a desire, you become happy. Really, all that's happening is for the moment you become desireless, so you have a shantavritti, you know, and the mind is not creating any type of problem and reflects the ananda of your own being. But what you want is to recognize the ananda of your own being that is always there as the self of all vrittis. Does it require a shanta? You don't require a shantavritti at all. Not that shantavrittis are fine, and they will come naturally because you're not relating them to the world in a way that is upsetting. When we relate to the world through Ajnanam, it's very upsetting. Because everything is finite, everything is changing, you can't count on anything to be stable for any length of time. You know, so it's all dukkha, really. It's all sorrow, because all of the things that you like are also unstable. You know? But the self is not unstable. And once it's recognized, and you get to know yourself and recognize, wow, this being, the me that is always here, is the most beloved. There's nothing that is more important to me than that. Nothing that's more dear to me than that. And then the mind starts, its attachment becomes toward that and not toward, you know, fluctuating vrittis. And then you can actually live in the world without... You can engage in the world without being so needy or fearful, you know? Because your wholeness is not dependent upon it. Let's sort of stop.